Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Undergraduate Admissions and Race Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On October 10, 2012, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Fisher v. University of Texas at Austin. This case considers whether using race as a factor in undergraduate admissions decisions is permitted by the Equal Protection Clause. To discuss the case, we have Gail Harriet, who is a professor of law at the University of San Diego School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Harriet.
Fisher has been called by some the most important case before the court this term, and given its subject matter, affirmative action admissions by colleges and universities, it certainly has the potential to be the most explosive. And if oral arguments are any indicator, I think there's an excellent chance that this will be a 5-3 or maybe a 4-4 decision. Let me point out that Justice Kagan has recused herself from this case on account of her work as Solicitor General. And before anyone starts celebrating over that or mourning that, depending upon one's perspective, let me point out that it shouldn't make any difference to the result, given that the University of Texas won below in the Fifth Circuit. Ms. Fisher still needs 5 votes to win. A 4-4 decision would affirm the Fifth Circuit. But before I describe the case and the argument that I heard this morning, let me remind everybody a little about the already existing controlling case law so you can see where this case fits in. The most important case is obviously Grutter versus Bollinger, the 10th anniversary of which is coming up very soon. Grutter was a huge victory for supporters of racially preferential admissions policies. The Grutter majority conceded, as it had to, that discrimination against whites and Asians is still race discrimination and therefore must be subjected to strict scrutiny. It held, however, that the burden had been satisfied in that case, that diversity was a compelling purpose, and the rest of the requirements had been followed there. So it allowed universities to engage in some undefined level of race discrimination in pursuit of what the court's majority thought was a good cause, that is diversity. Indeed, at times the majority opinion in the Grutter case appears to be almost cheerleading for diversity as a cause. Diversity is the only purpose for which the court in Grutter allowed racially discriminatory admissions policies, at least under my reading, although there is some loose language about diversity being a good thing in the military ranks as well. Earlier, the Bakke case, the 1978 case, had rejected explicitly efforts to justify race-based admissions as compensation for past discrimination or as a means to increase the number of minority professionals just for its own sake. So diversity was thought to be special because it is thought to somehow benefit all and not just minority students. Everybody gets a better education, or at least so that the argument runs. So while Grutter appeared enthusiastic about racially preferential admissions policies, it's doing so on a very narrow basis. Just how far a college or university can go under Grutter is not very well defined, but Grutter also expressed hope, as many of you I'm sure remember, that all of this will be unnecessary in the future and that universities like Texas will not have to do this after 25 years, 10 of which we've already gone through. The trouble is, predictably, universities like Texas interpreted Grutter very expansively and thus were emboldened to ramp up these policies. So the question everybody wants to know with Fisher is, will the Supreme Court just nibble around the edges of this expansive interpretation, or will it take a big bite out of it, perhaps even overruling Grutter altogether? For the answer to that question, you're going to have to ask somebody who's either smarter than I am or more reckless than I am. But here's what I have to offer based on what I know about the case and what I saw at the argument. First of all, Fisher has some special facts that would allow the court to decide the case either broadly or narrowly, depending upon what they would like to do. Prior to the Grutter decision, the Fifth Circuit had held in Hopwood versus Texas that the University of Texas could not use race at all in their admissions policies. So there in the Fifth Circuit, no race-based admissions policies were permissible, starting, I believe, in about 1998, if I have the year right there. And the Texas legislature, in response to that, adopted what they call the 10% solution. The top 10% of every high school in Texas would be automatically admitted to the University of Texas. And this seemed to produce a lot of diversity for Texas. It produced a class that was over 20% African-American or Hispanic. It also produces a class that was almost 20% Asian. At any rate, once Grutter was decided, in fact, the very day that Grutter was decided in 2003, the University of Texas announced that they were going to start engaging in direct preferences for African-Americans and Hispanics now that Hopwood was no longer controlling authority. And they did so. The first class that they had that allowed them to do this was the entering class of 2004. And their class that year was 21.4% African-American or Hispanic, 17.9% Asian. So it had a lot of diversity, not that much more than the percent solution had given them, just a little bit more, but nevertheless, more. Two big issues that stood out right from the beginning. One, the University of Texas had come very close to admitting that it was motivated not by the educational advantages of diversity, but by a desire to reflect Texas's demographics. And another issue, they claimed that they needed diversity not just at the student body level, but rather in every classroom. And they freely admitted it didn't have to be absolutely positively each and every classroom, but they argued that they were justified in giving racial preferences because the percent solution, while it gave them a large number of underrepresented minorities, or at least what some people could consider a large number, but it didn't make every classroom and every major racially diverse. At the argument, perhaps the biggest single issue that the court seemed to want to grapple with was, where does it end? How can we define critical mass such that the court can decide whether or not that's what the University of Texas is trying to get when it discriminates on the basis of race in admissions? Is there some magic number? What is that magic number? If there's not a magic number, then what is meant by critical mass? The University of Michigan in the Grutter case was permitted to engage in racial preferences in order to get critical mass so that minority students would feel comfortable speaking out. But they didn't define it at Michigan, and the numbers were much, much smaller there. So that ended up being a lot of what the justices were talking about in their questions. At one point, Justice Sotomayor joked that you can't define critical mass in terms of numbers because that would amount to a quota, and, well, as she puts it, quotas are illegal. Scalia pointed out that if we can't quantify it, we ought to stop calling it critical mass, because critical mass is all about the exact amount where particular change occurs. That's our issue, I suppose, and that's likely to be the way the case is decided, although it could be decided on a more narrow basis. It could be decided on a broader basis. Another issue that came up a couple of times in the questions is a much more basic issue, and that is, does the plaintiff have standing? Or, to put it a different way, you know, is this a case or controversy? Ms. Fisher initially applied to the University of Texas, and when she didn't get in, of course, she went to a different school. She went to LSU. Well, the case has been pending several years now, and she graduated in June. So she does not seek an injunction. This is not a class action, so there's not an effort to get an injunction on behalf of others. What is asked for in the complaint is she's asked for her money back. She paid a certain amount in order to have her application considered. She now says that it was considered unfairly. It was considered with regard to race, and therefore she should get her money back. Texas argues that, hey, you'd have had to pay that amount of money anyway. That's not your damage. I guess the correct way to look at that is to say this is essentially an unjust enrichment claim. She paid that amount of money, and it's admittedly small, but she paid it, and the University of Texas got to keep that amount of money, but they never fairly considered her application. So that actually got a lot of questions, and one of the things that the plaintiffs pointed out was the case was bifurcated as to remedy, and so there has not been the opportunity to flesh out the facts there. They did not ask for a specific amount of money for the value of a University of Texas degree over an LSU degree because they hadn't conducted the discovery and done the work necessary to do that. And the court had wisely, perhaps, bifurcated that issue so they wouldn't have to flesh that out. And so plaintiff's position is that that's still something that they are able to make a claim for should the case be remanded for further proceedings. A lot of people like to count votes. I'm not really much of a vote counter. I didn't notice in the oral argument any judge asking questions that surprised me. The conservatives seemed conservative. The liberals seemed liberal on this issue. So if you want to know what Justice Kennedy said, Justice Kennedy sounded like he was one of the conservatives. To me, the biggest change that has occurred in the last few years since the Grutter case is not so much a change in membership of the court, but rather it is the mounting empirical evidence that racial preferences are actually doing more harm than good, even for their supposed beneficiaries. There were no questions on that. That doesn't surprise me. It actually would have surprised me very much had they asked questions about that. Maybe it's not even appropriate for members of the court to ask questions like that. But I can't help but believe, given that a number of the briefs address this issue, that it's lurking in the backs of the minds of some of the justices. If the research is correct, I believe it is, we now have fewer African-American physicians, engineers, lawyers, and other professionals than we would have had using race-neutral methods. Affirmative action has backfired. I'm sure that back when the Grutter case was decided, the five-member majority had good intentions. But the Grutter case has always been painfully difficult to square with traditional strict scrutiny doctrine. The majority opinion, as you might recall, talked in terms of applying scrutiny, but deferring to the law school's educational judgment about the need for diversity. Strict scrutiny and deference are usually regarded as opposites. The court can't simultaneously defer to a defendant's judgment and put that defendant's discriminatory policies under strict scrutiny, and yet that's what happened in Grutter. It's sort of fitting that this time around it's the University of Texas that's at issue, and of course the University of Texas was the university involved in Sweat versus Painter back in 1950. Suppose the court had deferred to the judgment of academics in 1950 about the need for racial segregation. Where would we be now if that had been the case? At any rate, there were not questions about mismatch, but it would surprise me if no member of the court took that to heart and didn't think about the notion that, well, you know, we went way out of our way in Grutter to allow for racial discrimination because we thought, unlike most racial discrimination, this racial discrimination is doing good. Now it turns out that may not be true. Indeed, it is very unlikely to be true.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.